Okay, good afternoon, everybody. I'm David Shukoff. I'm the director. I have to look down to my notes to figure that out. After a powerful experience like this, I'm very pleased to welcome you to this afternoon's installment of Afterwards, our post-show discussion series. And I'm deeply pleased to introduce our two guest speakers. To my left is Professor Carol Gilligan, psychologist and novel, whom Time magazine once referred to as one of the 25 most influential Americans. So I wonder who the other 24 are. But anyway, yeah, we have one of them here tonight. And her extraordinary book, In a Different Voice, published in 1982, perhaps not coincidentally the same year that this play was written, has been called the little book that started a revolution. She's the founder of the Gender Studies program at Harvard and currently a university professor at NYU. And of course, most recently has published her first novel, Kira, which I commend to your attention. And of course, and there's more information about Dr. Gilligan in the insert in your program. So welcome, Carol Gilligan.
Thank you, David.
And also to my right is our director, James McDonald, the extraordinary artist whose work is also being seen down at the Public Theater. I hope some of you have seen Drunk Enough to Say I Love You, now currently at the Public Theater, and a frequent collaborator with Carol Churchill. And of course, James's bio is in your program. I won't take any more time with introductions because we want to get to the heart of the matter here. So I want to start with you. We were talking in the wings and on the phone here. It strikes both of us. I don't know if you know In a Different Voice, James, but at least two of us here agree that the book and the play, in a funny way, are kind of a gloss on each other. Mm. I don't know, it's really interesting. For example, I was struck by many things in the book, but. At one point in the book, when you talk about a colleague's work somewhat critically, psychologist Janet Lever, you characterize your work. Janet Lever implies that given the realities of adult life, if a girl does not want to be left dependent on men, she will have to learn to play like a boy. Now, I don't think that's a proposition that either you nor Carol Churchill would subscribe to, but it might be something that Marlene might say. And I just wondered if we could just kind of use that as a jumping off point for sort of an investigation of, you know, where, you know, Marlene and the world that she's in, Thatcherite England, and her values and how they're relevant today.
Well,
just for starters.
Just to start, I would say that, first of all, James, I loved the play. I thought it was terrific.
Thank you.
And I think... Congratulations to you and your cast. I thought that the girl, what's her name?
Angie,
she had the last word. Frightening.
Yeah, right, indeed.
And the interesting question really is, why didn't more people see it as frightening? Then, I mean, Carol Churchill did. In a Different Voice basically says, when women come into what was called the human conversation, would they change the conversation, not just simply join it on its own terms? And so I think the play, it's interesting to me because the play seems so current in 2008. And I think it's interesting why that's so. Why you wanted to do it again?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. What drove you, what impelled you to... See the play as being something worth, you know, important to do today.
Well, I've done a lot of her more recent work, and this play comes from a time before I knew Carol, so I was fascinated to look at this period of her work. But yeah, when you read the play, it does seem that it's mostly posing a whole set of questions that haven't gone away.
Exactly.
In fact, in a lot of ways, it was a prophetic play written at the beginning of the 80s. Because it poses the question of what happens if we don't take care of people like Angie. And this is very strongly articulated, and it's the emotional heart of the play in the last act. And
so a character who's characterized as stupid, lazy, and frightened. Right.
Yeah.
And what about her? You know, and then she's in at the end of the play, which actually occurs in Act Two, the real epitaph is she won't make it. Right?
She's not going to make it.
She's not going to make it, yeah.
Yeah.
But she's the one who sees making it in those terms as frightening.
Mm-hmm.
And the abandonment, really, of Joyce and everything that Joyce sees and stands for. I mean,
absolutely.
I think it is. It's amazing, really, when you think, what is this, 26 years? And that's the issue is stuck right there.
Just this morning, Gail Collins about Lily Ledbetter, you know, and the whole compensation issue and, you know, that whole, you know, issue of women in the workforce. I mean, it was just as recent as this morning.
I mean, you see Marlene becoming like the drunken father. That she, you know, describes with such contempt. I mean, in a certain way, and so.
Well, you've written a great deal, of course, about adolescence, and of course, we've sort of, in agreement, the pivotal character perhaps in the play, even though Marlene is the center of the play, Angie is probably the pivot. And what I mean, you've already spoken a little bit, but let's talk about the dilemma of being an adolescent, particularly an adolescent who's, you know, well, seeking her way in the way Angie is in this play.
Well, also, who doesn't fit in? I mean, it's right. In a certain sense, you see Angie at the point where... But the interesting thing really is what Angie sees is obvious, right? It's obvious to everybody here. So the question is not how odd is Angie, but what happens that people lose the perspective that Angie has, and that's certainly the question that has interested me. I mean, Angie sees it. The last word of the play seems to me the judgment on what it means to become top girls in those terms, which is it's frightening. Why hasn't it been transformational? That's the question.
Right, and that is a question. I mean, it was 26 years ago that you wrote
in a different voice,
and it was 26 years ago. And yet we're saying that the issues that the play is addressing are still, you know, are with us. So. What's your take on that? Why are we not, you know, in a different place?
Well, I've just written a novel, and the central character is an architect, so that's what she's interested in, is the structure of things. And there's a place in the middle of the novel where actually a character who happens to be a therapist says that if women don't challenge the structures in which we find ourselves, that you have to ask why aren't women challenging the structures, and that's to me. That's the question. I think this play is asking that. I mean, that's the question very much with us at the moment.
We've been talking kind of heady thematic talk, but let's talk a little bit about the process. I mean, clearly this is a play, you know, that complex in many ways. It doesn't have a strong narrative, you know, in the plot sense, and yet, of course, it tells a story. One of the special challenges of, you know, for instance, I'm sure a lot of people, you know, are confronted when they see this play with, you know, these characters from history and legend in the first act, and then they all go away, and then we're in an office place, or first we're back in Suffolk, and then, you know, with two teenagers, and then we're... So what was the process of making a coherent whole out of those seemingly disparate elements? I know that's a huge question, but maybe you could speak, you know, pick some aspect of that and try to help us out a little bit.
Well, the challenge is, as you say, to make all those elements feel homogenous, but actually thematically they're very, very strongly linked. It's just that Carol's a writer who loves to play with form and loves to play with ideas. So what she'd written, and this is the thing that attracted me to stage, because it's never actually been done before, is a three-act play in which each act has a very different structure, which reflects what she's trying to say in it. The play starts with a celebration, and it's a celebration of a woman who appears to have achieved something, which is a small thing in the big ocean, but she's arrived at being managing director, and so she summons up from somewhere all these women from different periods of history. So we start with what appears to be a celebration of a moment, the moment of the early 80s, where suddenly things seem to have opened up for women as a result, really, of the extraordinary things that happened in the 70s in terms of, you know, pushing forward a women's rights. And it appeared briefly to be a good moment in Great Britain, the fact that we had a woman prime minister. And that's really that very specific cultural moment that the play is talking about. So Carol sets us this huge challenge of interweaving all these different stories from different periods in history. Women who've done remarkable things, but also the cost to them of doing, managing to do those things. And in a way, the question the scene asks and doesn't answer, but the play answers, is what is the cost to Marlene of where she's got to? And obviously, as you can see, the challenge of that particular scene was not only to research and interpret and develop all the top girls' different stories, but how to do this very complicated interlaced dialogue that she writes. And the simple answer to that one is just a huge amount of practice. It's like kind of playing a string quartet or something like that.
I think that's an apt metaphor, because it strikes me that the way this play works, generally speaking, is more musical than sort of conventionally dramatic, where ideas and impulses sort of, you know, keep surfacing up in different keys. You know, this seems to me, and I think you've underscored the parallel between the first act and the third act by the placement of the table, you know, sort of roughly, and the idea of the form of the two acts emotionally, of, you know, act one and act three, seem to me, you know, strikingly similar.
Yeah. It is something, the play is something like a tapestry, and the first act is a It refers a little bit to Judy Chicago's tapestry, the dinner party. If you know that work, that great feminist artwork, and the second act you could call a tapestry of different working women and their attitudes and their ways of surviving within the male-dominated world of work.
I was just going to say, but the emotional center, at least as I felt it, is in the third act, and it's with Joyce. And I thought that was very powerful.
Absolutely. And it's a surprise in the play, isn't it?
Yes,
that the emotional heart of the play lies with a character who you're not expecting to produce it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Indeed. I think maybe this is such a heady play and we've thrown out so many thoughts here. It's time maybe to engage you folks in the conversation. First of all, speak loud, keep them short so we can really hear from our experts here, and make them questions. Okay, there's plenty of stuff to comment on about this play, but let's see about what is it that we, how can we help you, you know, by asking a question. In the back there, go ahead, stand up, would you please? Maybe the question has to do with the first act, which does question. And maybe the thing to do, perhaps, James, I mean, I'm not sure we can answer the question directly, but maybe indirectly, you know, by talking a little bit, it strikes me that one way of thinking about the first act, I don't know if this is true for you, is that each of the characters relate to some aspect of Marlene's situation. I mean, does that make sense to you? And, you know, and her issues and what's going on, is that a way of thinking about the other characters in Act One for you or not?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, she's chosen characters who all compare and contrast, and we imagined when we were rehearsing it that there has to be a particular reason why Marlene has sought them out as a friend. So they all have things that they bring to her. And particularly, I'd say, in the area of just getting out from under, getting away. One of the big themes of the play is either being stuck or being able to travel. You notice a lot of people in the office are obsessed with a lot of the girls who come into the office want to travel, or who work in the office, indeed. And that seems a big metaphor in the play for the possibility of having a broader horizon than the one which you're culturally repeatedly presented with.
It strikes me that the flip side too is of that same coin is the idea of being deracinated, uprooted. You know that you're not firmly anywhere anymore. Values are in flux, and a lot of the women in the play, and you know in the first act, and also seem to be at a loss as to where they are. They're moving on isn't necessarily, you know, a desirable thing. It seems to be their condition. Would you agree with that or?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Over there, yeah, sir. Which is, yeah. Right. And I think, if I may interrupt, I think that haggling is an interesting word, because it's not just, you know, I think the idea of the overlapping dialogue isn't just about, you know, that's the way life is. It's also about the fact that the voices haven't sorted themselves out, you know, that they're not able to listen to each other and really hear each other.
Yes, I think that's a very good point. And she's trying to make a sort of poetic thing that gives you flashes of information, but it really doesn't matter if you don't get the whole thing. That's not the idea. She's trying to give you the energy of a dinner party and these shards of different historical moments in which women were battling with different things, and to give you the energy of a celebration.
Well, I thought the interesting thing is, I mean, particularly now looking in light of the third act, is these triumphal stories of these women who she summoned to celebrate with her all have very sad parts to them.
Indeed, and the shape of the first...
So in fact, if she actually listens to them, it's a much more disturbing dinner party.
Indeed, and in fact, especially when Griselda comes out, she actually has to leave because she really, it's so hard for Marlene to hear that story of passivity.
But the Pope story.
Yes, indeed, exactly.
And the one with the emperor. I mean, these are stories that are supposedly triumphal stories, but if you actually, I mean, they anticipate the third act when you see what's the underside of Marlene's story.
And it has the shape.
It's very clever.
Right, and the shape of the first act, I think, in that spirit, goes from celebration to a sort of a lament. And then the final big beat has to do with, you know, Dolgret, who's the rebel, who led the rebellion into hell. And if you notice, the third act really has this parallel shape. It starts, you know, I brought gifts, I have, you know, here we are with the perfume and the dress and reunion, family reunion. And then, of course, toward the end, she's in tears, lamenting, you know, for reasons. And then at the end, and then they have that political battle so that they, you know, again, that defiance, but it's divisive. It's the two of them at each other, rather than that sort of solidarity of the first act, you know, of Gret, you know, saying we'll take on the devils. Anyway.
But you know what I wonder in the third act is whether it literally, first act, I'm sorry, is whether it's literally a hard story to hear. Mm-hmm. And then you have the dilemma of being the director of how do you stage what's a hard story to hear?
You just keep trying to make it clear any way you can.
Carol Churchill was here for some of the process. I mean, how did she, you know, how did she feed into the work on the, you know, that we're seeing today? Is she the kind of writer who is constantly saying, do it this way, or is she more sitting in the back of the room and saying, yeah, well, that's fine, or whatever? How was that like working with her? And of course, you've worked with her quite a bit, so.
She's always a brilliant person as a writer to have in the room because she loves actors and acting and loves being around them and is incredibly understanding of how actors need to work and the space they need in their own process, and she's always interested to discover new things in her own plays. So unlike some writers, she's very happy to give the actors space, but then she does have a strong idea of why she wrote the thing a certain way. And if you get stuck at a certain moment, she will tell you very gently and with great wit what it was she was trying to do.
In the back there, yes. Is there any relevance? Well, they're not all mythological. Some are, three are, and two are historical. So what about myth and, you know, legend and history? Is there any relevance to that, is the question. James?
I don't know. Yes, I think it's interesting if you think that the first act could be happening in Marlene's head, then it's a very free place, her head, yes. She may as well conjure up imaginary people as real people. It's what the ideas those people have that matters to her.
Well, one is a figure in a painting.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the other is a poem with an asterisk next to the name.
Yep.
Right. And Griselda, of course, is a character in a legend.
A character in a poem.
But Isabel Bird and Lady Nijo were actual, you know, personages.
We're real people, and they're both writers, interestingly. There's something in that as well for Carol, I think.
Both of you mentioned that Joyce is the center emotion. Can you elaborate on that?
Joyce? Well, for me, actually, I would say Angie, but so I think we have a slight difference. Yeah. But you're our guest here. Talk about Joyce as the emotional center of the play.
Well, this just on a feeling level, and the third act, just the emotional weight is really, I felt with Joyce as she says things that just the emotional truth of what she's talking about that can't be talked about in the top girl's world. And I thought two most powerful moments for me was when she walks out and says, no, pet, no, what is that line?
Right,
that
she's not going to make up.
The friend to the woman who embraces Margaret Thatcher and all that she represents, this uncaring about what happens to people. It's a whole set of values that Joyce's life embodies, that Joyce embodies. And I think what you feel is suddenly the emotional weight of these values and the emotional vacuousness of the life that turns away from those values. I felt it. I wasn't prepared for it. It was very strong. Did other people feel it? And then when Angie at the end says frightening,
yeah,
you can see she is Joyce's child in that sense, at the same time that she'll go on to pursue Marlene. Yeah.
I think what Carol set out to write in the play was a critique of that moment in the early 80s when it looked an unquestionably good thing that women had more power and opportunity than they'd ever had if they were to embrace the world of Thatcherism and the world of opportunity and the world of the individual, so-called. And I think there was a similar political moment here at roughly the same time.
I think it's this moment is still here.
Indeed.
And yes, it's a prophetic play in that sense because it's still with us, and it got worse before it went better, if it got better at all throughout the 80s. So what she did in the structure of the play, sorry, just to be brief.
Sure.
She start with a celebration, and you end with a nightmare. You end with a young girl going frightening in her sleep, you know? And the movement of the play is the political argument of the play is that what looks like a wonderful moment for feminism in Act One, so girls are on top, girls can achieve what they want now, is not worth having, the third act argues, unless you also have socialism, unless you can take care of the people at the bottom of the heap. And that's what was annoying her at the time she wrote the play, was a certain strand of feminism which thought that this individualism was an unquestionably good thing, and she very much didn't feel that. She thought that feminism without socialism is really pointless if you can't care for everybody, and if you can't have a social organization that does that, then really don't bother.
I think someplace she's quoted as saying, it started out to be a feminist play and wound up being a Marxist play, you know.
That's unfair to feminism.
Well, I'm just quoting the author.
Marxism is very
So terrific. So maybe as we're drawing close to this, I mean, in the last couple of minutes now, we've heard from the audience and from either side of me a sense of, so where are we now? You know, and maybe that's a good way to end. I mean, here we are. It's sort of revisiting, you know, these issues 26 years later, whatever it's been. So where are we now? Are we exactly in the same place as we were in 1982? Have we moved forward with respect to these issues?
Okay, I'll be provocative. Symbolizing where we are now in America, we have what would have been unthinkable in 1982, which is an African American man and a woman as, you know, final, what do you call them, contenders for the Democratic nomination. And I think the question for both of them is the same question as this play, because in fact, if they embrace the value of top girls, you know, and it's symbolized by questions about health insurance, about who cares about the people who really economically are in the situation that Joyce is in the play. It's a question for both of them, because if they do the top girl thing, then it will be a Pyrrhic victory. It will really betray the deep ethical vision of the civil rights movement and, I would say, James, the feminist movement, you know, which I think is basically committed to that kind of social values which women traditionally held. Anyway, I think that's why I think this play is terrific right now. That's the issue.
And I think on that note, we'll call a halt to this. Thank you both. Thank you, Dr. Gillingham. Thank you, James. It's really been a pleasure.